We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back in to another episode of the Lawyer You Know podcast. And I've got my dad, Big George, coming back to talk about this week, what happened in the Karen Reed trial. He's got some thoughts on some mistakes he thinks Hank Brennan made in his trial strategy, especially with regards to Yuri Bukenik. We're going to go through all the witnesses that testified this week, and we are going to get his take on the ruling made on Friday by Judge Cannone, with the Commonwealth experts changing materially, in my opinion, their expert testimony and allowing them to split their testimony in a way that I find incredibly unusual and incredibly unfair. But we're going to get his take. That's what this podcast is about. Make sure you guys hit the like button. Let's get into it. All right, Dad, we're back. Another week in the books, 4-day week. So actually, before we get to, I do want to start with where you think Hank Brennan is making mistakes. Did you have any issue with them taking a day off in the middle of the week because Karen Reed was sick and her dad said it was more along the lines of she was absolutely exhausted, not getting sleep, all of the medical issues she has was not one of the reasons she missed. What were your thoughts on them taking a day in the middle of the week?
I don't think anything's wrong with it. I think that, you know, you leave it up to the judge, but I, you know, you don't want her having nodding off during the trial or having, you know, issues during the trial. I think, if I remember, doesn't she have Crohn's disease? I think.
Yeah, but her dad kind of said in an interview that it didn't have anything to do with any of her other medical issues. She was just exhausted. And sometimes exhaustion can be a real thing. You can be dehydrated. You might not be able to get out of bed. You can have dizzy spell, you know, whatever it may be. I don't have a problem with it. We have had issues before where either a client or an essential witness is sick and you got to take half a day or you got to take a day off. Usually not for the lawyers. We show up sick. I was thinking about, you know, the weapons of mass destruction trial we had. And I was so sick in the middle of it, but we still showed up. We still did it. It was pre-COVID. So people were a little less sensitive back then. But that happened. So not a big deal there. But the beginning of this week, and even on Friday when we recorded last time, we weren't really fully into Yuri Bukenik's cross. So we want your take on that. But you said with regards to him, he kind of made you think Brennan made a real mistake with his trial strategy. So let's start with that before we even get to the testimony of Yuri Bukenik.
By the time we finished going through just some of the highlights of his testimony, when I did that, I thought back to myself and said, you know what? What if Brennan would have done an opening statement like this? You know, people don't deserve to lose their lives. And I don't care if you lose your life in New York City or if you lose it in Canton. Just because you lose in Canton and you have lousy investigation and a lousy police force doesn't mean it's any less wrong. And that, you know, we have officers that don't, you know, use red Solo cups. We have officers that have been disciplined and fired. All that stuff happens in Canton. But does that mean that justice can't prevail for whoever the person is who loses their life? And that's what you've got to focus in on, is a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt, not how bad the investigation was or how bad this police force was, because you know what? I can't help the way these guys are, but I sure can defend truth and justice and try to protect the innocent from being victimized by other people. And just because you live in Canton doesn't mean you should get away with it. I would own up to the fact that it was a lousy investigation, a lousy police force, and lousy guys like Proctor. And I just own it. And just think how that would take the sting out of so much of the defense case if he owned up to that. And I think that's the way he should have started this case. And I think he'd have been better off, especially, you know, when we finished this witness, you know, it sure would have looked a lot better for him if he'd admitted it.
He's doing the exact opposite. I don't know if I would have quite admitted it as strongly as you did, but I would have eaten at least some of it, like especially Proctor. You eat Proctor, you're like, we don't even need to call him. That guy, he sucks. We're not going to call him. Everybody else worked on this case too. We're going to call them. It wasn't perfect, but it was enough. The red solo cups, that's so embarrassing. But the evidence in it wasn't that important. You know, like that's really what he should have focused on, is that the important stuff was done right. Is that true? Is it not? That would be for the jury, but at least admit what is obvious, which they refused to do many times throughout Yuri Buchanek's testimony. What stuck out to you?
Well, you know, again, we're kind of now in the middle of his testimony. We started out, you know, right. And so the things that stuck out to me was the face, you know, his idea of, quote, his theory, you know, his theory in the beginning, and you know, why he had that theory. I hit him. He has some impact. He has some broken cocktail glasses, and he calls it in as a domestic, came in as a domestic. So he had his theory about what happened, and he went on that theory. And the fact that when he goes through this, you know, English is his third language, and he tries to make these excuses for why he can't understand questions or can't understand words. This man is defending truth and justice in his town, and you're telling me he can't understand the word theory? So, you know, especially he came across just...
Literally, right after he used the word theory, he acts like he doesn't know what it means.
You know, I know. And then he also tries to defend Proctor. He won't admit that Proctor was the lead investigator, although that's already come in that he's the lead investigator, but he fights the fact that he's the lead investigator. He won't admit things like, or he tries to defend the fact that he collected evidence, but he can't tell you where he collected it within a 50-foot area, because apparently it is 50 feet from the flagpole to the, you know, it's a 50-foot area. And he can't defend where he got the evidence, and he can't take a picture with his cell phone of the evidence or where he got the evidence. It just goes on forever.
What did you think about... Well, so two things I want to ask you, sure. Just any stories. Have you ever had a witness tell you they don't understand, you know, English when they obviously do, or ask you to get out a dictionary or something like that?
Yes. And it always comes off bad.
Yeah.
Because it's during my cross, when he understood every question by the prosecutor, the only time that he had trouble with the English language was during cross-examination.
And you bring it up again in closing.
Absolutely. So it always looks bad.
And you maybe bring the dictionary in closing and you say, we shouldn't have to use this book for very simple words, but for Yuri Buchanek, we had to, he asked for it or something like that. Yeah. It always plays well for a jury.
Right. The only time it's legitimate is if they have a translator through the whole thing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
if they don't need a translator for the whole thing, then they don't need it.
And then the second thing I wanted to ask were the honor and integrity for a guy that served in the armed forces, right? Came here as an immigrant, served in the armed forces, military police, law enforcement officer, you know, great background, kept using the words honor, integrity, and said Proctor acted with honor, integrity, even when they continuously threw Proctor's disgusting text in his face over and over again.
Yes. And he kept saying it. And you know what else I thought was really telling was the evaluations he did. You know, when he evaluated Proctor, and he basically lied, flat out lied in the evaluations. Of course, he lost 5 days, I think, of vacation time. Yeah. But he flat out lied in his evaluation of Proctor. And then when he's evaluating Proctor, he also says he never read Proctor's disciplinary action. Now, does that make any sense at all that you would be disciplined for the way you wrote an evaluation of Proctor, but you would never go back and read Proctor's evaluation where he got terminated? That doesn't make any sense. But he said he never even read Proctor's termination evaluation. So I thought that was pretty telling.
Well, yeah, because they asked if he was called the lead investigator in that, which is kind of
right. Yeah, so it was ridiculous. And just kind of moving on chronologically through his testimony. And then he goes to these text messages. He won't admit that the text messages between Karen Reed and Higgins were flirtatious.
Crazy.
And he fights the word flirtatious. That's what I'm saying. Brennan would have been so much better off if in the beginning he'd said, look, this is it, guys. We own it. It's screwed up. It's messed up. You did a bad job. When you're on the stand testifying, admit it. And we cut this, and we cut the defense in half if we just admit this, and we won't let them just drag it on for hours. Mm-hmm. And then we talk, and then they try to create, I think this was, at least I think it kind of fell flat. Maybe you don't think so. On the cross-examination of the fact that Higgins is a possible suspect.
You thought that fell flat?
I thought that fell pretty flat.
I just, from my perspective, the first trial, I thought it was so much better than the first trial. And maybe that's an unfair comparison for me because I saw how they did the third party culprit stuff the first trial. And it came off better to me this time. Higgins seems a little bit like a boogeyman, like a bad guy, like a villain, like somebody who liked Karen Reed, who might not have liked John O'Keefe. Like, I felt like they were able to paint him in that picture better this trial than the first trial when he was actually on the stand.
But you know, I just don't think they labeled him as a guy who's going to end the life of O'Keefe. I mean, sure, he was very weird. He goes back to the police station. I don't understand that.
Suspect. Like, why would he do that? Why would he do that?
Walks around with a cell phone outside, and then he gets rid of the cell phone on a military base. But he's
well, they don't know that the yet. They don't know that he got rid of the cell phone on a military base yet. That hasn't come out.
Okay, but he saved the text. They did say that they did not analyze.
Right.
His phone.
Download from his phone. But yeah, he was there. He was taking a snow broom and a duffel bag and moving it around in cars right after when the Commonwealth says, an hour after the Commonwealth says John O'Keefe died on the lawn. It's definitely suspect. It's definitely suspect.
And then we got the Cleo. We got the dog.
Clover.
Which, you know, he did another horrible job.
Yeah.
Investigating the dog. Can't even investigate a dog. I mean, he did a horrible job documenting his investigation of the dog. You know, that was really ridiculous. The questions that also I found interesting was they were allowed to ask him these questions, and this was the defense, based on your investigation questions. I thought that they got a lot of leeway on that because nobody asked for him to name the basis for his knowledge. In other words, it's so much hearsay that he was able to testify to, you know, based on your investigation. So they gave him a lot of latitude, but both sides did that.
Yeah.
And so I can't say maybe they kind of, you know, gave each other a wink and a nod that they could save time.
One of the feelings I thought is that both sides, he testified to way more than someone in his position would ordinarily testify to. You know, like the supervisor of the lead investigator usually does not testify about the amount of things and the breadth of things that Yuri Bukenik testified to in this trial. It was very unusual from that perspective.
Right. And you know, so they did. They let him get away with a lot of stuff on that.
How did you feel the Sallyport inverted video came off this time around?
What I liked about the Sallyport inverted video was where they located Proctor when they were walking around and where Proctor was located, where he was standing behind the SUV. I thought that was good. But, you know, if they, and I don't know how they will, but if they believe this guy, because this guy said, I was with Proctor the whole time. Mm-hmm. If they believe that guy, then that kind of clears up Proctor. But I don't think he's believable.
I still don't think it clears up.
And then the lie about seizing the Lexus, you know, that time frame, that was such a ridiculous lie, an unnecessary lie, you know. I mean, so that was a, you know, 4:12 is when it actually got seized. 5:30 is when he reports it seized. 5:45 is when he finds the taillight. You know, I just don't know why they would have to, why he would do that. And he would do that in the face of specific documentation to show when it was seized. So I don't understand why he would do that. So like I said, but then we can go, of course, we can go to the group texts, which you mentioned earlier, which you talked to, no news, retarded client, Yannetti photo, thumbs up, and
just acknowledging it versus, you know, it was actually a thumbs up. I mean, that was so stupid. Again, arguing about things that he doesn't need to argue about.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. If Brennan had just said, guy, own this stuff. Do not sit there and argue about it. Own it. You know,
he owned some of it, that it was horrible. You shouldn't say it. And everybody thinks that's a bad word to say. He owned some of it, but just not enough. And then he said he still acted with honor and integrity, which it's just, that's just a swing and a miss. You guys know I love cereal as a dessert, but I'm also a big protein guy, right? You got to get your protein in, which is why I'm so excited about today's sponsor, Magic Spoon. Now, when I first heard of Magic Spoon and I loved their high protein, zero sugar cereal, where you get 13 grams of protein in a bowl of cereal, which is something I'd never heard of before. But they also have what they're now calling Magic Spoon's high protein treats that are crispy, crunchy, and airy. Me and Maverick are always fighting over the marshmallow flavor that happens to be our favorite right now, but they have all sorts of different flavors, chocolate, peanut butter, blueberry, whatever your fancy is, they have. And I love to get these treats that taste good, but are also high protein. That is a very difficult combo to have, but Magic Spoon has found a way. And now you can give it a try with a little discount. Get $5 off your next order at magicspoon.com/LYK. Or you can even look for Magic Spoon on Amazon or in your nearest grocery store. That's magicspoon.com/LYK for $5 off. And let me know how you like it.
Yeah. So, you know, if he just would have taken it easy, lightened up a little bit, I got the same thing. You know, in politics, they talk about a 24-hour news cycle, which means if there is something bad that happens, you admit it right away. On the next day, they're on to another story.
Absolutely.
Same thing happens in testimony.
Especially in a long trial, right? You've had 6-month-long trials. It's like there's going to be bad days. There's going to be bad days in a trial that lasts week after week after week after week. And it's like, if he can at least... That's why I always try to tell people, like, think about what is the Commonwealth proving with this witness? As long as they get in there, get a couple things they need to prove that they can argue about later or build on for future witnesses. There's a couple highlight witnesses, expert testimony, but like, you've got to get through and over the bad stuff. You can't act like it doesn't exist, or else it becomes highlighted. It becomes the theme of the whole trial. And that's so much worse off for you.
And the jury is going to remember it more. They're more likely, that's a better word, they're more likely to remember it if it drags on for a while and you sit there and argue about it.
Yeah.
Because if they ask one question, you admit it, and they move on to the next question, they might not remember that question or that answer. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's what he did, is he just created these news cycles that didn't make any sense. But the Commonwealth, I think, did a good job when they came back with the common sense argument. I thought that those were pretty good.
The redirect, you mean?
Yes, the redirect. I thought that was a pretty good job.
What do you mean the common sense argument? I don't know what you mean.
Remember, he said, isn't it common sense that the taillight is close to the ground, about the hat, the grass stains on the pants? I thought that, you know.
Maybe it's just because I know other things are coming, but I did not think that was.
Oh, I don't.
Okay.
And I looked at that and I said, yeah, you know, common sense.
Well, the defense's theory, which I don't think they've made very clear, is that they dragged him out there and that's how the grass stains got there. But I don't think that that's been very clearly discussed or, you know, proven is the wrong word, but really put before the jury.
I did like that Higgins was interviewed with a lawyer present in his house.
What do you mean you like?
I always laugh because there's always a negative connotation. As lawyers, we think, oh, that's everybody's right. But the whole world thinks negatively when you have a lawyer around. And you know that the jury, I had a trial once down in Fort Myers, and my client had a lawyer, and they wanted to get in exactly the same thing. They wanted to get into the fact that he wanted a lawyer before he was interviewed. And the judge wisely, I think, told the prosecutor, you can ask him about the interview, but you cannot ask him, didn't you want a lawyer? You got to stay away from that.
Right.
And so I did think it was interesting that they got that in. And I do think it reflects negatively. I think the jury's going to look at that negatively.
The jurors, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And then another thing that I thought was funny was when he testified the first time, if you listen to his testimony, what he said was, the information he got from McCabe was, did I hit him? Could I have hit him? Mm-hmm. Those are the first statements he got from McCabe. Now, later it became, I hit him. But he did testify that was the initial statement that he heard from McCabe. And so I thought that was important. So that basically, you know, I kind of covers him. I mean, he was a lousy witness. He's a lousy police officer, and he did a lousy investigation.
That's not a great way to summarize somebody that's they're trying to put forth as the lead investigator or the lead cop on the case. The next piece of evidence that came out after Buchanek was another couple clips of Karen Reed making statements about, even if John O'Keefe knew about Brian Higgins' text messages, I don't think he would have lost it. Maybe we would have broken up. Definitely hurting Higgins' motive. I think it was a little speculative, and potentially, I don't know why that was admissible besides that Karen Reed said it, but I do think that the Commonwealth was able to use it to dispel the motive a little bit.
And I think they were, because I tell you, I think the Higgins thing is not, at least to me, is not coming across like, you know, this is the guy that did it.
Okay. So you think it's right now mostly the biggest highlight of the case is how horrible the investigation is?
Yes. And then the glaring fact that they have no evidence, they still presented no evidence of a collision.
Right. We'll get there.
I know. But right now, as we sit here, the whole defense has been how lousy the investigation's been. Yes.
Yeah. The next witness was KF, a minor, the niece of John O'Keefe. Did you look into any reports of what she said?
I did.
Okay.
And I mean, again, I don't know how, she came across on the stand, because obviously we didn't see her.
So I talked to Daniel.
What she said, she just talked about the relationship.
Let me give you this insight real quick. Ted Daniel, Boston 25, in the courtroom for this testimony. I talked to him yesterday, and he said she was very poised. She even cracked some jokes about, you know, she went through a breakup, eighth grade breakup. So it was a very big crisis to her, but she was very poised, was able to walk through it. It wasn't like Peggy O'Keefe, who was, you know, crying and difficult to get through the whole time. And that Yannetti crossed her appropriately, kindly, but still asked some pointed questions like, you didn't call Karen Reed the defendant throughout your entire relationship with her, things like that, that they did a lot of things together. So she was poised was the word that he kept using.
Yeah, again, I don't know how relevant
her
testimony was.
Okay. Zachary Clark was the next witness.
Not much there.
Crime scene services guy.
Yeah, you know, he really didn't. He took some photos. They didn't let him answer the question about seeing Proctor drinking with Albert in the cruiser.
They got it out. They got the question out.
They got the question out, but they didn't let him. They didn't let him answer the question. And then the hot mic issue, which again is no issue. I mean, really,
yeah, I don't know what he said.
Yeah, it's no. I mean, for as far as the, you know, guilt or innocence, the hot mic has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
So he wasn't much.
Okay. You know, let me see what else we got.
Evan,
Trooper Brent.
Yes. Another crime scene person.
He did call Proctor the lead investigator.
Yes, he called him the lead investigator. And he had some interesting things about finding stuff on top of the snow, on bottom of the snow.
Yeah.
I thought those were kind of interesting. He did some digging with shovels, apparently, to find some information. But again, he did say there was no damage to the Chevy Traverse, which was important because, if you remember back, we didn't really talk about it, but the Ring camera shows that Karen Reed backed up and apparently did hit the Chevy Traverse, because the Chevy Traverse did move slightly on the camera. But the fact that there was no damage to the Chevy Traverse, I think, is going to be important to show whether or not the taillight could have been damaged by her hitting the Chevy Traverse. So that, I think, that was an important little bit.
Okay, the next guy was the DNA guy.
I didn't see anything.
Me neither.
Yeah.
Okay. Then this was a big witness, the crime scene lab tech Hartnett. The female witness, that's a civilian witness. I thought she was a pretty big witness, actually. She's the one that looked at the scratches and dents, found the hair on the car, the glass on the bumper, things like that. What stuck out to you?
Well, she was a necessary witness because they had to have her for the chain of custody. Because later on we're going to hear some testimony. So she was important. They had to put her on. But I tell you, frankly, I thought she was a great witness for cross-examination. I thought they did a tremendous job on her. First off, again, she tried to fight it, but those hairs were not in the same place in those two pictures.
Seemed that, obvious to me.
That hair moved.
Yeah.
And sitting here arguing about it just didn't make sense. That hair moved. And then we have the glass. And to me, the biggest thing about the hair and the glass is it was been towed. It's been through storms. It's been through whatever it has been through. But it came to that, I guess, the Sally Port. It's there. And that piece of glass is still just sitting there. Something you can remove with tweezers without any problem. The hair still sitting there after going through a snowstorm. I think that was a big deal. I think that really goes to the defense theory a lot.
So explain, how would you use that as a defense attorney, right? So it's like they show the video of him, like the snow or something falling down when they closed the window on the Lexus. And she's like, it fell on the floor. He's like, well, it could hit the bumper on the way to the floor. And yeah, the conditions, the fact that it was on the tow truck, that it was sitting in the Sally Port for that long. And yet we're supposed to believe a magical hair in glass. I've heard people in the chat call it a magical hair. That really stayed on through all of that period of time. How realistic is that? How would you use it as a defense attorney when arguing to a jury?
Well, first of all, you know that the Commonwealth is going, because I think they've got that part of the DNA evidence. Commonwealth is going to rely heavily on the DNA evidence.
Yeah.
And that just, to me, destroys the DNA evidence, because how can it be reliable beyond a reasonable doubt that this stuff was on the vehicle at Fairview, right? Fairview, yeah. I think that's right, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How can you believe it was on the car at Fairview? It hit the guy there, O'Keefe there at Fairview. It drove from Fairview to someplace else. It got towed from someplace else to the Sally Port. All that happened in a snowstorm, and the DNA hair is there. It's unbelievable. It just is unbelievable.
And the glass, even the glass is unbelievable to me, right? Yeah. I mean,
yes, the glass, they didn't find any DNA. Was the DNA on the glass too?
Yeah. I don't know if they found DNA on the pieces of glass, but there was DNA on the cocktail glass that was broken.
Right.
It wasn't glass from the taillight. So they say it's glass from the cocktail glass. It's all very confusing.
It's unbelievable. That's the whole point here. That is a cold, hard fact in my mind. That it is unbelievable. You just can't possibly say, you know, we talked about common sense earlier. I mean, your common sense has to be that stuff could not have gotten on there at Fairview. It had to come from somewhere else at some other time. I think that's a big deal.
Yeah. And if it did, that means they're planting evidence, right? I mean, that's the point, is there has to be a logical conclusion to some of this. The DNA, well, I guess we're not really there yet, but like, it's not surprising that John O'Keefe's DNA is on this stuff, right? It's his girlfriend's Lexus. He was inside the Lexus. He was wearing the jeans. He was wearing the shirt. So the fact that the hair in the glass was on that back part of the car is important, because if he was hit by the back part and it took an arm hair off when it hit him, you know, his arm's bent, it's all scratched up. It took an arm hair. He's holding the cocktail glass. It gets smashed. It stays on the bumper. That would be really important evidence for the Commonwealth. But if you don't believe it's physically possible that it stayed on there, and Hank Brennan tried to make arguments that hair or water is an adhesive, and so with the snow, the hair stuck on there. It's like, well, then how's it moving in this picture if it's stuck on there? It just happened to not be glued to the back of the car at the exact moment you decide to take a picture. Like, that's what you're asking them to. Is that reasonable? Is that proof beyond a reasonable doubt?
Right. And, you know, going back, you know, then switching to another argument we were talking about, If Brennan had owned the fact that this was, you know, the Keystone Cops and they didn't know what they were doing, you know, when he asked about the Solo Cup, it would have just been a bigger joke than it was when they asked this lady about the Solo Cup.
Trying to make excuses and be like, oh, hey, it's really too bad, but do you know the circumstances? Do you know how hard this investigation was for them? Don't you know how difficult it was for them to do this?
Yeah. Just leave it alone. They did it. It was stupid. It's a big joke. Everybody laughs at it. I'm sure that this this technician probably was even laughing when they asked it, because she's never seen it before and she's never seen it since.
So also from people in the courtroom, a juror apparently was making facial expressions when they were talking about the red Solo cups on cross, like laughing, like what a joke this is. So much so that on Friday, Judge Cannone had to say, hey guys, watch your facial expressions, have respect for everybody in the courtroom. Don't, you know, show emotion as a juror. So that's pretty interesting. And usually I don't think jurors like that. So what do you think? What do you think about that?
Well, you know, if I was a defense and I saw that juror, if I was Brennan too, and I saw that juror laugh, I would have thought, man, just let's just move on. And you know, let me prove my case and get away from this ridiculous law enforcement.
I love it.
You know, and just, you know, like for, and if Brennan in his opening statement had put a red Solo cup on top of there and said, look, ladies and gentlemen, let me just show you what a evidence gathering tool is at this police department, and put the red Solo cup up there, it would have just killed the issue all through the trial. You know,
you gotta be careful because they're part of the prosecution team and you can eat it, but I mean, you gotta be careful about highlighting it and making it like the whole part of your opening statement. I think that I would not have gone that far to really make it like a big prop in opening.
Know, Brennan's in a unique position because if he was an assistant prosecutor full time and had to deal with these law enforcement agencies full time as a prosecutor, that's different than he's a one in and one out. So he's going to be gone after this trial. So he can.
I don't mean like that. I don't care about that. I mean, the jury is thinking you're a team with them. So if they suck, then they're horrible. How do you win if all your teammates suck? That's what I'd highlight as a defense if he went with that theory.
You distance yourself from a bad police agency. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
But you got to keep enough to still be able to prove your case. And I don't know if they would have had that. I guess you just go with your new experts that you have this case and you forget about that stuff. Yeah.
Because that's their case. They're not proving this guy guilty by red Solo cups.
And you can still say they're bad Keystone cops, but that they didn't cover it up or plant evidence or do stuff like that.
Right.
It wasn't intentional. Yeah.
Right. They're, I hate to say this, but they're too stupid to plan this.
That's what I would argue. I actually think that's a good argument. That they're too dumb and negligent and lazy to actually plant this and prove it.
Right.
Anything else from that witness? Let me see if I had anything.
No.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. You're right.
How about she swabbed the entire taillight with only one swab? How she argued about the reflection of that sticker? Was it two stickers or one sticker? What did you think about that? Talked a lot about Whitney getting me a lot of Grease shirts. Well, I did something on my own this week. I got a pair of light linen pants to wear in Grease, and I'm incredibly excited. I didn't even know where to look for something like this. So I start where I start all my clothes shopping now. At Quince. Quince has all the things we actually want to wear, and they're such quality material. But the best part, everything on Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than what you'll find in similar brands because it's really high quality. Like, I am pumped to wear these linen pants with all these different kinds of shirts in Grease, and Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes, and you can tell when you wear it. So now's the time to elevate your closet with Quince. Go to quince.com/LYK for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/LYK to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/LYK.
Again, why? Why sit there and argue about it? You know, it just didn't make any sense. It was obvious to me, at least maybe it was one sticker, you know, and then finally what she should have done is she would have looked great if she'd have done this. She said, you know what? You're right. You know, I'm looking at
exactly.
It now.
What's the big deal?
Yeah. Mr. Defense lawyer, you are right. That's one sticker. Yes, sir. And you know, she would have just come across great if she'd have done that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I agree. I thought that was a big mistake. Okay. Oh, what did you think about just the fact that there are scratches, dents in that area of the car only? She looked at the rest of the car, no other damage like that.
Well, unless they're going to be able to connect it up somehow, I think
it's good foundation for their expert, though, right? I mean, yeah, if their expert can use it, it's seemingly good foundation. Like, if you're the jury, I'll tell you what, I'll just tell you how I looked at the first trial. I was like, okay, all right, doesn't look great. Cops look horrible. Investigation sucks. But if they have an amazing accident reconstructionist that puts all this together, then maybe they would be able to get there. And they had the worst expert I've ever seen of any trial I've been a part of or watched on YouTube. Trooper Paul is their accident reconstructionist last time. So again, the same question looms large. What will their accident reconstructionist be able to do with all this information? That's really
And that's why I said they had to put this witness on to lay the foundation for what's coming later.
Yeah.
So I mean, they had to put her on. She had to testify to these things so that when later witnesses testify, it gives it context. So they had to put her on. And that, you know, the scratches and all, she didn't establish anything with those scratches, but they had to put her on because she had to establish they exist and how they exist. And then later on,
swabbed and what she gathered and stuff like that.
Right.
Okay. Next is Dr. Scorti Bello, who I thought was one of the biggest, most important witnesses so far, the medical examiner. And I want to take some of your experience when we ask questions here, but what stuck out to you about her? And I've got a lot of follow-up questions.
Well, let me explain something first. And a lot of people don't understand this, and it frustrates me as a defense lawyer because I always disliked it. There's a difference between a pathologist and a medical examiner. A pathologist just will tell you what is the cause of something. The medical examiner looks at the manner of death, cause, manner of death, two different things. The medical examiner is allowed to take a look at police reports, evidence, witness statements, all that stuff to come up with, and I think the wording that she used was one manner of death over another.
Right.
So they can come up with one manner of death over another manner of death. And that's why it frustrates me as a defense lawyer, because I'm not just questioning her on her medicine or on the science, but she's also doing a factual investigation of the case. And that's the difference between a pathologist and a medical examiner. So that's the point. And if a lot of people were looking at and wondering, you know, why all these questions and why is it so important that she was unable to determine the cause of death or the manner of death, not the cause, the manner of death, is because that's what medical examiners do. So she looked at this, and I got to tell you, I wonder, maybe there's a reason, I'm wondering now whether or not Brennan regrets even putting her on.
Well, the reports were he's not going to call her. And the reports were that the defense may call her because she's going to be such a good witness for the defense. But the one good thing she got out for the Commonwealth is that there was hypothermic changes, or that hypothermia was a cause, but not the primary cause of death, but still undetermined on the manner of death.
But I also think that there were some kinks in the armor on hypothermia as well.
Sure. I agree. But the defense, I mean, at least the Commonwealth got that out.
Right. But I think she was, they established her independence, which obviously was important. They established, you know, she's her own person. She has her own department with her own investigators. She did indirectly, I don't know if you call, but if you put the thing together, she did indirectly label Proctor as the investigator in charge of the case.
Everybody has.
Yeah. So she did that. She established the intoxication. She did a blood alcohol. I think it was
John O'Keefe.
You're right, 0.12 or something like that.
0.21 to 0.28, I think it was.
Something like that.
Whatever.
So they established the intoxication. So, you know, anybody who thinks that these people weren't out drinking that night. She established the intoxication.
But as a prosecutor, how often did you have a medical examiner that wasn't able to come up with the manner of death as homicide?
As a prosecutor, never.
That's what I'm saying. It's unusual. It's unusual, especially in these types of cases, for them not to say homicide. Just because it's a homicide doesn't mean it's your client, right? Just because it's a homicide doesn't mean that person's guilty. So it's not, she's not really in the place of the jury, but that's what the defense is trying to do. Put the jury to look at her and be like, she's an expert and she had all this stuff. And I thought Brennan absolutely, no doubt about it, stepped in it on his redirect when he was like, well, did you know about this? And she's like, yes. I think he was like, oh crap. You knew about the confession of I hit him. You knew about the police reports. You knew about what this person said, what that person said. You knew all that and still undetermined. That is so unusual. If you had a witness like this, how important would it be to the defense?
Well, here's what happens. Just backtracking a little bit, we're talking about when you said it as a prosecutor. Sometimes I had medical examiners who couldn't tell me that it was from getting hit by a car.
Right.
Or but what they could say was homicide. So, you know, so they could label it as a homicide, and then it would be up to me to prove who did it and how.
And that is less bad than what we have right here. So it's still not perfect. You right. want them to be able to say this was a car accident for sure and a homicide. It was purposeful, whatever. But this is about as bad as it gets, just to have undetermined.
Yeah. And what's really bad, and you know, we've gone, I said this 2 weeks ago, I guess. Mm-hmm. They've got to believe the I hit him statement. If the jury doesn't believe the I hit him statement, they can't, they're not going to convict her.
But it's, I don't care about that. So the medical examiner could still believe that Karen Reed said I hit him, but she's like, I'm looking at the medical evidence. I'm touching the medical evidence. I'm dissecting the medical evidence. And not only did she say that it's undetermined, she said these injuries are inconsistent with a car accident. That's crazy bad evidence for the Commonwealth.
Right. And she also knew a bunch of other stuff. I mean, he went through the list.
Yes.
And unfortunately for him, about half the list she said she knew about. And then I think there was another question, and I can't, that was, knowing all you know now,
yeah,
would you change your report?
No. That was, nobody asked her that about the undetermined. The defense asked her that about hypothermia.
Just hypothermia?
She says no. I thought they were going to ask that, but they didn't. You know what they didn't ask about? The injuries to his arm. The Commonwealth didn't ask if that had anything to do with a car accident or anything consistent. They didn't. They just completely stayed away from it, which to me feels unethical. It feels like, you know, you can't prove this case. Your own medical examiner is not telling you that she was hit or that he was hit by a car. That's the like internal struggle I have, because it's like, if I'm the prosecutor, I'm not going and looking for another expert at this point. That is the person that's objective and they're telling me that. I got to live with it and I got to have a tough conversation with the family. That's what it comes down to me. When she gives that opinion, how are you possibly going forward on this case?
Well, and you know, another thing they could have done, another medical examiner. You know, the Commonwealth could have gone out and had another medical examiner give another opinion. That happens all the time. And they didn't. Why they didn't, I don't know. Maybe because no other medical examiner would give them a different opinion.
I don't know.
But they could have gone out and found another medical. It's going to be very tough for them to overcome this in the jury's mind, that she could not determine what the manner of death was.
And I
don't know how they're going to. I find it very difficult right now looking at it. It's an unbelievable mountain to climb for the prosecutors at this point. I mean, she nailed it for the defense.
Yeah. And absolutely. Two more things real quick on her was, number one, another mistake by Brendan is, if he didn't call her and the defense had to call her in their case in chief, the defense can say, oh, this is a Commonwealth witness, she's their medical examiner, but it doesn't look the same when she's called in your case in chief. When the Commonwealth calls her, now it looks like it blew up in your face.
And also keep in mind, if the defense would have called her, they couldn't lead her.
And the only direct question, I think it would have gone well, but different vibe.
Totally different way.
Yeah. And then number two, she also crushed the person the Commonwealth is going to rely on, who is a neurosurgeon. That's who they are going to call. And so when it comes to the fact that we're looking at a situation now, the Commonwealth called this expert, she puts on her expertise and she says a neurosurgeon should absolutely not be doing this. This is my expertise. And Stonebridge, who I think is also going to be good for the defense, that was also a crushing blow to the Commonwealth's case.
I am not as convinced as you are that the neurosurgeon couldn't rehabilitate himself when he testified.
I said he can. When it comes to brain, he's going to be the king of it.
Right.
But it was just still pretty great for her to say, cause and manner of death is not for a neurosurgeon to determine.
I agree with that. I think
the injuries and the causation and mechanism of the injuries, but I don't know.
Well, she did another thing and we haven't mentioned is this pattern of the falling backwards and the pattern of the injury.
Yeah.
I thought that was really important because the defense was trying to make a point that this couldn't be from hitting the hard snow. Mm-hmm. And she personally said, absolutely, it could be.
Right. I thought that was good for the Commonwealth. And the defense, that was an own goal by the defense. That was an unforced error there.
Yeah. So I think that was that pattern of the what it looked like in the back of his head, that's going to be real important because, to their theory, to the defense theory of what happened or how it happened. So I thought that was good. Wishnowsky spots?
Yeah, Wishnowsky spots. That was all about the hypothermia, yeah.
That was the hypothermia. And so I thought that there was the cross was good. I thought the cross was good on the hypothermia myself. Okay. It was long. It was complex.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I think that jurors get lost and stuff like that.
But you had to do it. And I think the thing that didn't get lost was most of her cases have 50%.
Yeah.
And this case had 10% to 15%.
Of the pancreas or whatever has the spots, and this was like 10%.
Let's see.
That probably wasn't the best explanation for people that didn't watch the entire trial, but I don't want to get into the weeds on the hypothermia.
Right, but again, that's the statement I think the jury is going to remember.
Okay, and the medication that he was taking and the alcohol, and so you would expect to see some of those spots based on those two factors as well, which came up on, I think, recross.
Right. So number one, I thought she was a reasonably good witness. I mean, as far as witnesses go, I'm not saying who she was for or against, but she was better than we've been seeing, and she didn't do as much arguing, and she spoke with authority. So that she was believable when she gave opinions.
Yeah.
So I thought that she was, she did a pretty good job. I don't know if I would have called her if I was the prosecutor, but he did.
And also she gave the defense that certain injuries on John O'Keefe's face would be consistent with a fight or an altercation, which I thought
was
good.
Getting hit with a glass because that was the point is if you explain ekgonosis, the ekgonosis, it wouldn't explain this. So there had to be a frontal injury. There had to be something that hit him here in order and also hit him back here.
Yeah.
So he got hit in front and the back.
And then we're going to talk about the argument, the issue with the experts at the very end. But that was interesting because right after that, I thought the Commonwealth, again, I think this point could go either way, but the clip that they played Friday, the first clip was Karen Reed saying, I picked the piece of glass out of his nose and it started gushing out blood. So that doesn't sound like it was a fist fight, right? If there's a piece of glass there, but if you pull it out of his nose and it starts gushing blood, he also probably hasn't been out in the snow for 5 or 6 hours by that time. Cause I don't think that's what would happen. So just kind of,
well, you know what else gushing blood. And again, I don't know if they're gonna bring this up, but this is just layman expert me.
Yeah.
His heart was still beating because if you pull that out,
right,
you don't gush blood unless your heart is beating. So when she pulled that out of his nose, if you, again, her theory, he was still alive.
Yeah. That was another just weird comment that I don't know why she would make that comment, but it is what it is.
I saw that too. I listened to a little of that today. So I did see that. Yeah.
Another thing is, so Officer Keefe said he went to the autopsy by himself. Turns out there's a picture of two people. The other cop was bald. Everybody's saying it's Proctor. I'm like, guys, remember how many bald cops there are in this case? I was like, it might be Proctor. That would be so bad for the Commonwealth if it's Proctor. But it turns out it's not Proctor. It was Trooper Watson and Trooper Keefe. But still bad for Keefe because he said he went by himself. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I got to be honest with you. I don't remember if that specific question was asked if he was there by himself.
Yes, he said he went by himself on positive.
Did he? Yeah, I see.
He was the only one in his unit that went.
As a juror, I don't know if that was just not something that stuck out in my mind that he was there. The only thing that stuck out in my mind was Proctor wasn't there.
Okay, then we had the forensic scientist too who talked about, the drinking glass had John O'Keefe's DNA on it, blood on the jeans was John O'Keefe's, shirt John O'Keefe's, The hair did not, they were not able to determine that. And the cross by Unetti was no taillight pieces tested. Other DNA samples could have been anybody. They didn't run it against the cops to see if it was the cops. Surprise, surprise.
Run it against the Alberts either, I think, right. If I remember right.
Right. And surprise, surprise, John O'Keefe's DNA is on his own clothes in his girlfriend's car. Thought it was a pretty good cross, but again, foundational witness for the Commonwealth. Anything that stuck out to you there?
Well, the fact that there was always, it seems like everything, just about everything had two other people that were unidentified on there as well, but no one cared to identify those two other people. Apparently nobody cared. The norm would be, and I'm again going, if I go back to a federal investigation, the Bureau would have taken everybody's DNA that had been anywhere near the place and compared it. These people didn't bother doing that. And so that, I thought that was kind of interesting that nobody cared to find out who those other two people were.
Then we had the person that fit all the taillight pieces back together, put it together and put it on the rear taillight. So we saw how it worked. And also said that the debris on John O'Keefe's clothing was consistent with clear plastic pieces. Anything from that?
No.
Okay.
I do remember back, this is the same clothing, right, that she found in a bag altogether that was scraped up from the ground.
Yep.
And no one...
There could have been debris also in the bottom of the bag. Yeah, I mean, it's just horrible evidence collection. And that was a big part of Cross where it was just like...
Yeah, you don't grabbed it off the ground, threw everything into a bag, and then expect it to become evidence.
Exactly. Yeah. That's tough. And how do you do that? Like, as a defense attorney, how big of a deal is that? How much do you focus on it? Do you think it's obvious common sense, or how technical do you get with, like, they're trying to act like they picked out these pieces of taillight from a shirt when in reality, it's like, scrape it all up, throw it in there. There's debris in the bottom of the bag. Like, how do you make those arguments?
Well, you make the, well, first of all, you ask the right questions. You don't have to spend an hour on it, because everybody's going to know. So once they admit that, you know, this is just a mess and a big garbage bag full of stuff, you can just leave it alone and save it for closing argument. But you got to get them at least to make the initial admission that, you know, they did a lousy job once again. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's get to the big argument. So Hank Brennan's expert on May 8th gives a new report, or an updated amended report, with a new time of incident from 12:31 and change to 12:32 and change. They turn it over to the defense on May 11th, so literally in the middle of trial. And this is after, and the arguments the defense makes is, we've structured our whole case, our opening statement, our cross-examination of every witness, including Ian Whiffen, on this time discrepancy, how they are just dead wrong. Their experts are dead wrong. Their experts disagree with each other. This is reasonable doubt. It's inconsistency in the evidence. And now you're just going to let them change it, Judge? And Brennan asks for, Judge, ARCA is taking forever to get us this stuff. We finally did get it. Our expert can't prep in time, so we want to present our case on everything we know. And then in rebuttal after ARCA goes, we want to have our expert come and testify again and basically have two bites at the apple, two case in chiefs on this issue. And Judge Cannone grants everything to the Commonwealth. Yes, you can use the new time. Yes, you can split up your witnesses and have them go during your case in chief and all new information on rebuttal. She does allow the defense, the opening for the defense, to potentially recall ARCA after that. But how screwed up is this? How unusual this is? Are you surprised? Was that a material change? What are your thoughts on what happened with all those arguments and the judge's decision?
Well, I think it's a material change.
Absolutely.
It might not be in a lot of cases, but in this case, it's a material change. I mean, was it 20 seconds difference?
Yeah, something like that. But
it makes a big difference. And the reason it makes a difference, and the way they discovered it, was because the one expert, Burgess, I think his name is.
Oh, it's Burgess is one of the new experts, yeah.
Yeah, Burgess saw a telephone analysis, saw that the telephone analysis didn't match his analysis, went back and looked, found out a 21-second calculation that was wrong in the clock, and changed his opinion. So, I mean, it was absurd that he would do that after. I mean, he had this stuff was all available before the trial started. It was nothing. This was not new with stuff. It was a new report or new analysis.
He changed his opinion. He changed his conclusion and opinion. And Brennan was like, we've been talking about time discrepancies the whole time, Judge. It's like, well, then why can't you just leave in the wrong time and explain that it's a no big deal time discrepancy? Because you know it actually is a big deal. That's why you want to change it. So how unfair is it for a defense attorney? Because you've had stuff like this happen where, guess what? Just spoiler alert to everybody watching, this is not the only trial stuff like this happens in. Prosecutors get to change crap and add crap and change dates and screw up our defenses all the time in cases. The judge almost always lets them do stuff like this, and it's so unfair. You've had stuff like this happen after you've deposed all the witnesses. They change the date range. And it's like, so now I've got to completely recreate my defense. Even sometimes in trial, they'll change dates on a charging document. And you're like, what? How is this possible? How is this fair? But I think they were allowed to do it in either the Daybell or Lori Vallow trial as well. So how do you deal with this as a defense attorney?
Well, number one, you realize the judge is not going to dismiss the case. So you've got to fashion, all right, how do you deal with it? Normally, here's what happens. Normally, the judge will say to the defense lawyer, well, you need some time to analyze this and get ready. You know, we're right in the middle of the trial. A judge has the authority to give you 2 or 3 days during the trial to work on it. And I've had judges do that. Well, we'll just let the jury go until next Thursday. And should that give you enough time, Mr. Tragos? And the appellate courts have always sustained judges that do that.
Right. You give them time to respond, react, plan. Right. If you're really going to do something like this, you give them time. And she could have done that with Hank Brennan instead of giving him. How unusual is it to let them basically have two bites at the apple with their expert after the defense has put on their entire case in chief? Their expert can just come and testify to anything that, not just what they bring up in the defense, not just that, but any testing results or new opinions that ARCA has today already that they should already have to deal with in their initial testimony. But no. She's going to let them come and comment on it after the defense has already put on their entire case in chief.
Yeah. You know, and I don't see how she thinks this is fair. I mean, you know, I just don't think how she thinks she's giving, you know, a fair trial to the defense by doing it that way. Yes, you're right. If ARCA testified to something that was brand new in the case, then yes, I can understand her letting these people come back and testify afterwards. But if it's not new stuff, then they should get their whole case done and that's it. They're done unless ARCA brings up something new. Now the jury, without a doubt, is going to hear their expert twice. And that just gives him added credibility. Mm-hmm. It gives them the ability to tailor their testimony, because I can tell you what's going to happen. I really believe this. Their expert is going to be able to listen to the ARCA testimony.
Like he's been listening already. I'm not clear on whether the experts are subjected to the sequestration order. There's some gray areas there.
Well, according to the order, from what I've seen, she's going to let them ask them about sequestration in cross-examination.
Well, we'll talk about the cross that the defense can have on this. But anyways, keep going. You said you're guaranteed this is going to happen. They're going to watch the testimony.
I think they're going to watch the testimony so that they can be, again, the quote's going to be, so that they can, you know, respond to new stuff. All that's going to do is prepare them for cross-examination so that they're going to get up there and do it again. Yeah, I don't know why she did it this way. And I've never seen it done exactly the way she's doing it, but she's doing it. And she's going to get away with it probably unless the defense is going to show some real prejudice. If I was the defense, I might even ask for a day or so to prep. They didn't ask for that.
Right.
Which I thought was kind of unusual that they didn't ask for a couple of days to get
ready. But
the
problem is, their problem is not their guys prepping. Their problem is the Commonwealth is acting like it's impossible for their expert to prep. And guess what? Judges don't usually care. They're like, no. Too bad. Make it happen. Your guy's got to be prepared to testify whenever you call him. They have all the information. ARCA turned it over like May 7th or something. It's like, how much time are you going to give them to respond to the new testing done by ARCA? Like, it's just normally judges are like, too bad. Tell him to work on vacation. Tell him to work on the weekends. Tell him to work overtime. He's got to come up with his opinions by the time he testifies. That's what I was surprised didn't happen.
And Brennan also said, oh, our guy can't work on weekends, or our guy can't.
Yeah.
You know, he was whining about that as well during his argument.
which I get it. People have lives and you don't want it to be like that, but this would not be the first judge to force people to work in a way that they don't want to work.
Yeah. And it does change. It really does. It does change things. Now, I don't know how dramatic ARCA is going to feel the change is, but it does. From a layman's point of view, you and I watching this trial, we know how it does change things. And, you remember Brennan's opening. Brennan had a specific, his opening was about as specific as you can get when it comes to minute by minute and second by second.
The data is with us.
That's right. And sure enough, it's all exploded now. And the defense apparently didn't have a right to rely on, what the state said they were going to prove.
It's horrible. It's absolutely a discovery violation. It's a new opinion. It's a different opinion. It's trial by ambush. It's all of those things. Like, here's the point. What he could have done is, while he's on the stand, say, Mr. Alessi, you know what? You're right. It is 12:32, whatever. You're right. And that still fits perfectly within my timeline. Yeah, you're right. He could have done that. And then Alessi can impeach him and whatever. And it's not technically a new opinion. He's just agreeing with Alessi on cross. He could have done that to change his testimony. And it's not a discovery violation. Instead, he's agreeing with him, but explaining how it's not, doesn't change their timeline or whatever.
Think of Alessi, though. Think you're up there cross-examining this guy. Think if you put your mind in Alessi, you're up there cross-examining the guy, and he tells you a new time. He tells you there's a new time. And you're going, what?
Yeah.
What?
But in that vein, before we go, I think this is going to be one of the best cross-examinations ever. Imagine saying, Burgess, when this trial started on April whatever, your opinion in your report was this was the time of the incident. On May 1st, your report said this was the time of the incident. On the day I crossed Ian Whiffen, your report said this was the time of the incident. On May 10th or May 7th, whatever, this was the time you said the incident happened. Not until May 11th, after we crossed all these witnesses, we did our opening statements, we've made our arguments, we proved to you were wrong, didn't we? And that's why you changed it. I would do that on cross. Okay. That's what he should do. It should be an amazing cross-examination.
Yeah. There's no doubt he's going to do it. Like you said, he's going to go through each of those and he's going to try to embarrass him as much as possible.
Absolutely. He should be embarrassed. So he was wrong. He's supposed to be an expert and he was dead wrong. Just a lowly lawyer figured it out and he couldn't. All right. So any other thoughts on that ruling from Judge Cannone?
No, we agree. It was not the right ruling. I would have done it a different way.
All right. So this is the final question I have, because again, there were reports he wasn't going to call the ME and he called her. There were reports he wasn't going to call Proctor and Higgins and the Alberts and the McCabes, et cetera. Do you think Hank Brennan is already changing his plan and strategy based on how this trial is going?
I think he's making adjustments. Yes, I think he is. I don't know. I can't predict. I definitely would not call Higgins. There's no doubt I wouldn't call Higgins. Higgins, there's just too much to cross-examine Higgins on. And he's just going to stumble and stutter through his testimony. I wouldn't call Higgins. Since we have proven to the jury how incompetent the Canton Police Department is and what a bunch of bozos, maybe he's going to think, look, Proctor can't make it any worse for the bozos on this. They've heard his name. I'd have to really, I don't know if I'd call Proctor either if I was him. I know I wouldn't call Higgins, but I don't know if I still might just say, forget Proctor and let the defense put him on.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't know. It's just so tough.
It is. Well, I know he's changing strategies. I know he's thinking.
What?
He's changing strategies. I know he's thinking during this trial, how can I make things better? Because things don't look good.
It really, to me, is all just dependent on the accident reconstructionist expert that they have. That's really what it comes down to. But all right, is there anything else you want to mention before we go?
If there is as good an arc as good, let's say they're both good, it's a not guilty.
Yeah, it should be. Should be, really.
Yeah, it's a not guilty. If they're both good, it's a not guilty.
Yeah, but we'll see how it all gets presented, right? Because ARCA's got more new information, new testing. So, and Hank Brennan said, we have some very grave concerns with how they did their work and the reliability, as if, ARCA's doing something nefarious or wrong. But we'll see how all that goes. Thanks for joining me. Thank you, everybody, for hanging out with us for another hour here talking about this Karen Reed case. on your weekend. Very valuable time. Make sure you hit that like button. Make sure you leave us a review on whatever podcast network you're listening to. Leave your questions in the comments. Let us know what you think about it. But that's all we got. Till next time, we are out of here. Thanks for watching another episode of The Lawyer You Know. If you enjoyed the episode, please hit the thumbs up and share with your friends who may be interested here on YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe. You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. And don't forget to check out The Lawyer You Know podcast with new seasons dropping every quarter. If you have a case you want to talk to us about, if it's a personal injury case, wrongful death, catastrophic injury, car accident, or slip and fall case, please email us at lawyeryouknow@gmail.com. And of course, all these links I just mentioned are included in the description below on this episode and every episode. So until next time, this is Peter Tragos, The Lawyer You Know.